Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
I credit Kirk with basically saving my life and my career. I'm up to, I don't even know, 15 or 16 surgeries now. In fact, I'm in a big brace right now. I just had a reconstructive surgery on an elbow, but I've had 5 shoulder, 2 neck, 2 knees, handful of other stuff.
Steve is a Navy SEAL, and his inability to sleep was affecting his body's ability to recover.
I was all over the place in terms of pain. I was having surgery, not recovering, and then one of the things he started to ask about was my sleep. And I remember thinking like it's an odd question, but no, my sleep was awful. When I went to see him, I had probably been averaging about 2 hours sleep a night, about 9 months to a year period.
Oh my goodness. When Steve went to see Dr. Kirk Parsley, he was a mess. Now, with the sleep cocktail, he's sleeping through the night.
So I think a key tool to getting your sleep right is taking the right ingredients, and it's easy in the sleep cocktail. Like the days I do that, my sleep is amazing. And my sleep is 8 hours of uninterrupted, I do not wake up, in vivid, vivid dreams.
Is lack of sleep affecting your body's ability to heal? Try Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.
Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. Jesse Lawler is the founder of the incredibly popular website, smartdrugsmarts.com. He is an expert in the area of nootropics, which this is a space that I have deep interest and appreciation for, but my expertise is about an inch deep on it. So I'm really excited to talk to you today. Jesse, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I'm super stoked that Squatchy put this together. I'm sure that we'll be able to cover a lot of ground, but give folks some of your background if they're not familiar with you, your website, and what you've been up to.
Yeah. Well, I started my podcast about 3 years ago, and it was sort of a hobby that I would do now and again at first, which was kind of just like an elaborate excuse for me to get some scientists on the phone. I figured if I just called them up and started peppering them with questions, they'd hang up on me if they even answered. But with a little bit of a veneer of credibility of having a podcast, I was able to have some conversations with some really smart and interesting people. And that dovetailed, and probably for about the past year, we've actually been publishing weekly and taking the thing more seriously. And it's at this point like an overgrown hobby for me, which has been just a ton of fun.
Awesome. That's a ton of fun. So you have a pretty varied nutritional background too. Like you've played with a lot of different things.
Yes, I have.
Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah.
So I'm like a second generation health nut. My dad, I think, was kind of one of the original like health food granola sort of guys from Southern California. I was raised in Oregon and an Oregonian. But so I grew up with at least half of my parents very interested in healthy eating. And so that I guess kind of rubbed off. And so I guess I was always interested in tweaking with that. After university, I got more and more interested in vegetarianism because like, and I don't know whether this had anything to do with it or not, but I still had like a little bit of acne, even when I felt like I was at an age where I really shouldn't be having acne anymore. And I found that when I changed my diet towards something more vegetarian and eventually vegan, that cleared up. Mm-hmm. I think it was actually probably the milk that I was reacting to in retrospect, but I didn't know that at the time. And as so often happens, When something seems to work, you just run full speed in that direction. I wasn't necessarily being terribly scientific about my fiddlings around with my diet, but yeah, I've done sort of run of the mill vegetarianism. I've done full bore veganism for I think about 6 going on 7 years when I finally stopped that. And for one of those years, I was actually a raw vegan. which is kind of the full lunatic.
The internet may melt down with me talking to a former raw vegan. Oh my God.
over a year, I kind of, set myself a dare to see if I could keep it up for 12 months. And I did, and made it until the Valentine's Day of the following year, when my girlfriend at the time convinced me to eat a burrito. And once that first burrito crossed my lips, I was like, okay, forget this. And it was a gentle slope back from there. But, I'm sure you've probably talked about this book maybe at some point in the past on your show, but there was a book called Catching Fire, mm-hmm. How Cooking Made Us Human by the evolutionary biologist Richard Wrangham.
Love the book, yeah.
Amazing book. And I read that for the first time, kind of probably halfway into my being a vegan, and I was really persuaded by the evolutionary arguments that he made. But in the meantime, it was completely at odds with the diet that I was eating as a vegan, because, he says, we've been, pretty demonstrably eating a decent amount of cooked animal products for the last, 1.9 million years. And that didn't square with veganism really well. The book was so interesting, though, that it was kind of like one of these things. It was like a little splinter in my mind that I knew I was going to have to come back and reread that later. I wasn't quite ready for the message at the beginning. But then I guess it would have been 2011. I ran into a couple of people at a conference that I went to who were really in amazing shape, and they were in not quite ketogenic, but like a very fat friendly sort of diet. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, wow, they're doing something right, because I mean these guys are looking more athletic than I was at the time, and so I got to talking with them about the diet that they were on. It made me think, I'm going to go back and reread that book. And I think having sort of been mentally primed by having met some people that were doing really well on a high-fat diet physically, I reread the book. And because I was never vegan for like any sort of ethical reason, fluffy little bunnies, were that high on my priority list. It was just sort of a matter of what was going to be best for my own physiology, whether I switched back to eating meat or not. And so I figured, I'm going to just kind of give this the Pepsi challenge. I'll try eating the diet that I thought made most sense in light of the evolutionary arguments laid out by Richard Wrangham in that book. And that seemed like, something pretty much exactly what you espouse on your podcast, seemed like the best fit for it. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this for 90 days, see how I feel. And, then make an educated decision, because at that point I knew what my body felt like as a vegan, which quite honestly was pretty good. But I made the switch. I was pretty constipated for about the first 5-6 weeks of that.
Oh, wow, really interesting.
I probably could have switched over in a more I probably should have had a bunch of acidophilus yogurt or something right at the get-go get the bacteria back in my gut that were used to digesting meat, because all the bacteria that relied on meat, they'd starved to death long ago.
Right.
And it was sort of a bumpy transition, and I did feel fairly bloated for a couple of weeks. But on the other hand, the thing that I really noticed was that doing the exact same amount of exercise as I'd been doing previously as a vegan, suddenly I started putting on a lot of muscle mass, especially in my upper body, compared to what I was used to. And that certainly helped with my giving it some emotional buy-in.
Right. That's awesome.
The thing that I still struggle with, and I feel like this is like at some point I need to make like a 6-month commitment to just researching the hell out of this, but there still is some interesting evidence for a vegan diet doing really well for cognitive performance for people very late in life, 80s, 90s, 100s, stuff like that. And I think that unfortunately, because in the good old days of ancestral living, back when we were living in caves and hunters and gatherers, probably very, very few people lived to those ages, and there wasn't a lot of evolutionary pressure for the diet that might have made us most healthy and athletic and robust, during our young breeding years, for having necessarily prepared us well for, being cognitively active as a 90 or 100-year-old. So it might be that there really is no perfect human diet in that sense, where we do have a little bit of a seesaw between what's good for us as a 20-year-old or a 40-year-old versus what might be best for us as a 100-year-old. I don't know. I probably don't think anybody really knows quite yet. But for the last 3 years-ish, I've been on a pretty strict paleo diet with allowing myself the occasional exception of dark chocolate.
Nice, nice. And I think that's a fantastic insight and an often overlooked discussion point within kind of the paleo ancestral health scene that almost anything that we do, you can make an argument that there's some sort of a trade-off. And you, in most of biology, we see a trade-off between kind of health and longevity and what we would call fitness, and fitness generally being like kind of reproductive status, like really high androgens, high energy flux tends to be a little bit antithetical to enhanced longevity. There is this interesting topic, the grandmother hypothesis, which was that there was a selection pressure for significantly enhanced longevity in humans relative to most other animals, because we have such a deep cultural base that having repositories of knowledge, even in, say, like a post-reproductive period, could be incredibly helpful, both for like child rearing itself and then also education and cultural transmission and all that stuff. So, I mean, there is some argument for the same things that there were convergent influences, both for general fitness and reproductive status, but also in enhanced longevity in humans. And you kind of see this in some of the more advanced animals like elephants that have a pretty advanced culture, and apes and chimpanzees and stuff like that. But it's super interesting, and it's definitely something that I don't think people noodle on enough, although we're also just trying to get them to, most people, to stop eating like big gulps and snack wells and stuff like that. So, you know, talking about genetic pleiotropy and the reaction norms of various you know, epigenetic inputs are probably a little bit long in the tooth for most people. So,
yeah, I think that there's such interesting things to think about, though, because we do have like a lot of cultural technologies, for lack of a better term, that seem to be kind of cooked into our DNA to some extent. Like the universal human interest in story. I think, you know, in addition to having long-lived grandmothers, having, you know, stories, kind of the ideas of these memes that people inherently find interesting because they can attach to them emotionally, and that, you know, a story can outlive many, many, many generations if it's compelling enough, and, you know, presumably pass along some worthwhile information that, you know, further generations might benefit from, you know, by virtue of what a compelling story it is. And I think that you could certainly make the argument, I don't know if it's been proven yet, but that, you know, cooked into our DNA somewhere is an appreciation for story structure, among other things.
Yeah, I completely agree. Shifting gears just a bit, just because I am super excited to get into this topic of nootropics. Very, very observationally, I have noticed my own evolution in this story, and I've kind of followed some other people out of physical culture, like Frank Zane, Arnold Schwarzenegger, looking into Eastern medical traditions. It seems like in one's youth, we're very interested in aesthetics and performance, you know, muscle mass, leanness, you know, flexibility, whatever the case may be. But interestingly, as time goes on and people kind of progress through the life cycle, it seems like two things take really prominent importance for folks. And one is digestion and the other is cognition. And I think where we're sitting now, looking at like the glymphatic system and the gut brain axis and whatnot, and the incredible influence that diet has on cognition, we're kind of understanding how important it is. But I think it's kind of fascinating that most people, if they have a health orientation, the specific kind of physical performance focus seems to give way to a real attention to detail on the cognitive attention, you know, because you start realizing that if you lose your marbles, it doesn't really matter what your physique looks like. You're super screwed in that case. What do you think about that? Or am I out in the weeds, or what are your thoughts around
that? No, I think you're right on. I mean, I think, you know, most of us in our youth, to the extent that we want to, you know, maximize anything about ourselves, it's the ability to make, you know, the opposite sex want to mate with us. And so things like, you know, being stronger, being faster, being, you know, better looking, whether that's, you know, smooth skin or flowing hair or whatever it is, that kind of stuff is first and foremost. And, you know, also when we're young, our brains have quite a bit of, let's say extra capacities, like you can, mm-hmm. you know, go out boozing every weekend or even every weeknight, you know, in some people's case, and still kind of bounce back from that because we do have kind of a big redundant system upstairs in our brain that we can do quite a bit of damage to before it really starts taking a toll. But yeah, as we get, you know, later in life, whether that's, you know, 30s, 40s, whatever it is, and you know, most people have, if they're going to have kids, they've had kids by that age, and we do start thinking more about, okay, what's going to keep my brain functioning the way I want. I start thinking about, you know, myself, my cognition, what I have left, and the kind of things that define my identity, rather than can I get this girl to mate with me?
Right, right. So explain to folks what you thinking like 50 different things here and trying to figure out which direction I want to go first. So let's make an argument that cognition and brain function is really, really important, like for a ton of different reasons. You know, clearly avoiding pathology like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia is a biggie. I just think staying at the top of one's game, whatever that game may be, cognitive function is a huge deal. And so there's been an interest for a long time in pharmaceutical or nutraceutical agents and also nutritional interventions that can enhance cognition. And there's lots of different areas there. You know, there's certain cognitive elements of physical movement that certain substances and practices can help, whereas like math or language retention and aptitude are very different in how they oftentimes are tackled. What exactly is a nootropic, and where did this idea come from?
Wow, that's about 17 questions.
I'll
try to dissemble that a bit. First of all, yeah, it's great that you asked about the term nootropic, because this is one that people are going to see. You know, if you Google the term nootropic, you're going to find a lot of talk about a lot of things that technically don't meet the definition of nootropic at all. It's probably like if you Google health food, you'll see a lot of things advertised that neither you nor I would think are healthy.
Right.
But the official definition of nootropic, it was a term that was coined in the 1960s by the inventor of a compound called piracetam. And piracetam is something that, you know, both was and is used for treating things like early onset Alzheimer's and senile dementia and things like that. It's also been shown to be useful for younger people as well, even people that don't necessarily have any cognitive impairments yet. But when the guy who invented it was an Eastern European scientist, and he sort of said, hey, this should be like maybe the cornerstone of a new set of compounds that would have a variety of properties, and that we could call them collectively nootropics. The word comes, I forget what tropic means, but nuos, N-O-O-S, is the Greek word for mind, and it means something like mind promoting or mind enhancing or something like that.
Right.
But his conditions for what would qualify a given compound as a nootropic, I'm not sure if I remember all of these, but there were five of them, and it was something like it needs to basically not be addictive. It needs to not be something you can build up a tolerance to. It needs to promote cognition, which is fairly broad, but you know, basically make you think better. It needs to be neuroprotective, in that it makes your brain cells able to bounce back better in the case of some insult, whether that's whacking your head with a hammer or a chemical insult or whatever it is. And there was some other, you know, equally important and awesome sounding you know, prerequisite for being considered a nootropic. And honestly, any compound that could check all five of those boxes would be, by definition, almost a miracle drug. There would be no reason not to have as much of it as you want, as often as you want. Nowadays, when people talk about nootropics, I mean, you'll oftentimes see people, methylphenidate, Ritalin, that's a nootropic, right? And it's like, no, not really. I mean, it's addictive. It's a compound that has an amphetamine base. But normally when people see the term nootropics, they're going to what people really should be saying is either cognitive enhancer, or what I prefer is sort of the more general term, smart drug. Mm-hmm. And cognitive enhancers, like, you know, caffeine is a great example of a cognitive enhancer that everybody's familiar with. Nicotine is another one. These are things that do have definite benefits to some aspect of the way we think, whether that's, you know, better memory or better ability to focus or more alertness and attention. But they can also have some downsides too. As we know, caffeine can make you kind of jittery and anxious, and depending on whether you have a tolerance to it. It can, you know, make your heart race if it's not something you're used to. So caffeine would very much qualify as a cognitive enhancer. It wouldn't technically qualify as a nootropic. So that was one of the questions. So what were the what was the other
I think you ended up hitting 90% of my questions, and I ended up weaving so many questions into the run-on sentence that I'm not even entirely sure what all of them were.
No worries.
You know, it's interesting. I've played with a lot of these different substances: paracetam, vimpositine, DMAE, dimethylaminoethanol bitartrate. That's more in the nutraceutical side of things. I've played around with Deprinil on the more pharmaceutical side. I'm chewing some nicotine gum currently, which I've found to be just an incredibly huge boon for my focus and cognition. I actually, that got on my radar doing some research for the military, doing some public speaking for Naval Special Warfare. And I started digging around and looking at nicotine. And I was like, if this stuff wasn't, you know, reasonably addictive, and so long as you get it out of something besides tobacco, this thing's practically a vitamin, you know. What you know, out of these different substances, either nutraceutical or pharmaceutical, it seems like we're tweaking a couple of different pathways in the brain, either dopamine, acetylcholine. What's going on with those different pathways, and how are those altering, say, like one element of cognition? I've really noticed that I get a very favorable response from things that seem to tweak that kind of dopaminergic side of things, the acetylcholine side of things, like the paracetam, for example. Go-to cola doesn't really work so well for me. Like, what are the differences there in how these things are tweaking the different neurotransmitter pathways?
Yeah. I mean, it gets really complex, as we all know. I mean, it's like the brain is, or the body is very complicated, and the brain is like the most complicated, you know, thing that we've got within the body. I think it's kind of an idea that a lot of people would be familiar with is, you know, we know that alcohol makes you drunk, but getting drunk on beer and getting drunk on vodka and getting drunk on like tequila, you know, each have very different perceptual effects. And it's kind of, you know, there are a lot of drugs that will you know, cause the release of additional dopamine, or maybe take dopamine take more time before it's re-uptook by the cells that released it. But each of those are going to, you know, be affecting pathways in a slightly different way. And just because something is a dopaminergic drug doesn't necessarily mean it's going to have the same perceptual effects for a given person who takes it. That seems to be kind of true across the board. But yeah, most of these are, like, I guess dopamine is the first one to talk about when you're talking about, you know, cognitive enhancing compounds, because it tends to be when people sort of come to this realm of they've heard of smart drugs, like, hey, this is a thing, and they start looking into it. Most people are looking first for something to increase their focus. You know, why that is versus something that would increase their mood or increase their creativity, I mean, that's sort of anyone's guess. But I think increased focus is kind of what makes most people look under this rock to begin with.
Right.
And dopamine does seem to sort of be the place to go. If you had to pick one neurotransmitter that you want to, you know, modulate upwards, dopamine would be the one for, you know, increasing those feelings of focus. Dopamine, you know, kind of colloquially for a long time was talked about as like the reward neurotransmitter, kind of a biochemical pat on the head for doing something right. But, you know, that is no longer really the accepted view in the conventional wisdom over the past, you know, 15 or 20 years of research. And I think this is starting to kind of leak out into general culture, is that dopamine, what it does is it kind of motivates you to be willing to expend effort to pursue things that you like. So, you know, I like the girl in a bikini over there. But if I'm, you know, low in dopamine, I might not actually be willing to get up and, you know, walk across the room and introduce myself. If I've got a lot of dopamine, then, you know, I'm going to be thinking, oh, I could say these, you know, 10 clever opening lines, and I'm going to go over there and, you know, put on my best smile and actually try to do something about the fact that I like the girl to begin with. And yeah, so anyway, that's sort of, you know, dopamine in a nutshell. So when I've got a day that I know that I want to do something, maybe you know, cognitively tough, and that I might not be able to, you know, sustain my focus on for a long period of time. But I know that that's what needs to be done. Like, I guess by way of what I do in the real world a lot of the time, I'm actually a computer programmer by training. That's what I've been doing, you know, ever since university, writing software. And so, having those long periods of deep focus has been really, really useful for me. So the thing that kind of brought me into the realm of smart drugs, even being aware that this is a thing, was hearing about a compound called modafinil, which is actually an anti-narcoleptic drug. That's technically what it's prescribed for, to keep people from falling asleep mid-sentence. But it can also be used, you know, not just to keep you up, but it does tend to uptick the amount of circulating dopamine in the brain. And I found it to be pretty effective when I want to kind of put on the chemical blinders and, you know, stare at computer code and, you know, hit my fingers on the keyboard for, you know, 9 or 10 hours at a time. Not that that's good for any other part of my body. It's like sometimes you'll forget to get up and go to the bathroom.
Right.
But for banging out some code, it can be helpful.
I have the Provigil modafinil. I find that if I've got one day, maybe one day every 15 or 20 days where I'm like, oh, I've got a really sweet block of time. I had a good night of sleep actually the night before, so I'm feeling pretty good. I'll do actually a pretty small dose of the modafinil, like even like 50 milligrams. And I am on for that period. But what I've found is that I actually get if I try to do that a second or a third day, I get virtually no effect out of it. Like I accommodate incredibly quickly to it. And the magic, what's the movie where they take the pill and the Limitless?
Limitless. Yeah. The official movie of the nootropics.
Right, right. You know, I get basically one day out of like 20 that I can pull that off. So I have to really meter that one out. Have you noticed any similar effects? Or are you able to get some mileage out of that more frequently?
I'm able to get mileage out of modafinil. The problem with it is that it almost, like, even if you intend it not to, it always winds up stealing some of your sleep. You're not quite as tired at the end of the day. That's what it does. It makes sleep kind of an optional thing. You can sleep on it, but if I go to sleep with modafinil in my system at a significant amount, I can fall asleep. But instead of, you know, sleeping through the night, I'll wake up after a couple of sleep cycles and be like, well, I might as well just be up again.
Right.
And, you do that a day or two in a row, and then you've always got sort of the crash day where you're just not fully awake. I don't think it's necessarily a come down off the drug so much as just you've been, you know, borrowing ahead from your sleep rhythms.
Right, right. I've definitely noticed that. And that may even be where I've noticed that a smaller dose, and I literally need to take it about 6 in the morning. Like if I start pushing it towards like 10 a.m. or something like that, like I'm not going to sleep well that night, because it's really part of the effects is basically blunting the sleep pressure that occurs, which makes sense with the reason why it would be effective against narcolepsy, which interestingly is an autoimmune condition, which we've had a lot of success around that with kind of autoimmune paleo and whatnot. But what about any other either pharmaceutical or nutraceutical or other agents that you've had some good success with?
I've really been a fan of something called sulbutiamine, which is a synthetic compound of vitamin B1. It's like B1 bonded to itself. So instead of being a hydrophilic, it becomes a lipophilic molecule that crosses the blood-brain barrier more easily. It has both some benefits for physical energy, and I believe it's a mitochondrial ATP precursor, as well as being a beneficial for cognition, helping with things like memory, and that's something which I take on pretty much a daily basis. It's got an interesting history. It was like invented by the Japanese during World War II for people that were like at sea for a long time and didn't have access to foods they would normally be getting B1 in. But that's been one that I've been a fan of. And then another one, you said paracetam, that you weren't much of a responder to that. I wasn't much of a responder to paracetam either, but a chemical sibling called aniracetam. There's about 15 or 20 things with the suffix racetam. But of those, aniracetam has been the one that I've had the best results with. It tends to, for me, it's like really a creativity booster, which one of the things that's been shown in trials with big numbers of people to do is that it boosts your working memory. And what I believe is going on there is that by having the ability to hold more concepts in my head and my working memory at one time, I can kind of juxtapose those ideas up against one another. And lo and behold, every now and then you'll see sort of an interesting intersection of ideas and thus the creativity feeling that I get from it.
Oh, interesting. I would say that as I've climbed in age, that's one of the most frustrating elements that I've had, like the working memory, the ability to have 15 or 20 different studies and kind of the flow of those studies and what the significance is, that has whittled down over time. So it's like, okay, I can keep two studies in my head now, and so the ability.
It doesn't help that they keep making more studies all the time.
There's a shitload more studies, yeah, and you just have access to so much stuff. But the aniracetam sounds really interesting. What type of dosage is typically played around with that?
People take between, I want to say like 500 to 1500 milligrams in a day. It would be probably a par for the course. It's one of these things. Most of the racetams are really well tolerated. Although I should say not all of the racetams are taken in that sort of amount. Like paracetam is something that you almost take like these horse pills. Like when people are first in a loading phase on paracetam, they'll take something like 2.4 grams, not milligrams, grams,
right,
a day. And then, but they've got other things that also have that racetam suffix that are like 100, I think even 500 in one case, times more potent. So you're taking just these little, micro doses to get, a pretty strong effect. So it's important to kind of try to find out the correct dosing for these things and, tread carefully. And of course, you always be looking for, the minimum effective dose, kind of work your way up slowly, find out where your threshold is. There can certainly, especially for anything that's going to be stimulatory, whether it's, glutamatergic or cholinergic or whatever, there can be too much of a good thing.
Absolutely. And I learned that lesson painfully out of my youth. So it's a minimum effective dose is a super important concept to take home. So this is, I'm curious, because sleep is so incredibly restorative and important for cognition, for all of our metabolic processes, for healing, is there much research in sleep augmentation? So, a lot of the nootropics tend to kind of look at, okay, I'm going to take, say, like the aniracetam to improve working memory and creativity and whatnot. What about looking at sleep augmentation to try to get more mileage out of sleep and recovery? So we're not looking to specifically dose for the moment, but more in preparation for things down the road and specifically trying to enhance sleep quality. Anything going on in that arena?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people, myself included, look for anything that might be GABA promoting. There's a neurotransmitter called GABA. It's all in caps. I don't know why. It probably stands for something, but you just always hear it as GABA. But that tends to be sort of a relaxing, neurotransmitter to have, release. It's actually the component in green tea, L-theanine, that kind of makes green tea different than most other caffeine-containing beverages is a natural way to promote the release of GABA. And that's one of the reasons that you can drink several cups of green tea and get some of the mental perkiness that you expect from caffeine, but not necessarily have the anxiety effects that come from maybe a venti of Starbucks or something like that. So back to your question on sleep in general, there certainly are compounds that make one more likely to go to sleep. There's something called GHB, gamma hydroxybutyrate, which it's got a lot of bad press around that because it can be used. It was, I think, the second thing after Rufinol stopped being available as a date rape drug. If you were still a date rapist and wanted to be date raping or whatever, I guess GHB was what they went to next. And so there were, needless to say, a lot of bad press around that. But it's also supposed to be a very effective sleep promoting agent, although it's difficult to get one's hands on. It's something that you need a doctor's prescription for in the U.S. And I think there's only one lab that's actually allowed by the FDA to make it now. But one of the very first interviews that I did actually, it was mentioned, GHB in particular,
that of all the different sleep-promoting compounds out there, that's the only one that promotes all stages of right. natural sleep.
Right.
There's a lot of compounds that will essentially knock you out, that will make you cease to be conscious, but that's not quite the same thing as getting those normal cycles of restorative sleep. Tough nut to crack.
Oh, it is. And I remember using GHB in my powerlifting days, and I would do a morning training session, have lunch, and this was early in college, so I had a little bit of latitude in my schedule, and then I would do a dose of the GHB and sleep for somewhere between 1 and 3 hours. But it was like I had slept a whole 8 hour shift during that time. And then I'd get up and do another training session, and it was just incredible. And I seriously could throttle all of the people who ruined that for us with nefarious usage. Yeah. Because it was just incredible. Yeah. And I've never been able to track down a doc who was willing to write me a prescription for that one since.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. This week, I'm not sure when you'll be publishing this episode, but, Nancy Reagan just died. And, I guess, unfortunately, her legacy is sort of the just say no,
right.
Idea. And unfortunately, we still have this really screwy policy or group of policies sort of, across all of America where, the potential to misuse something just means throwing out a ton of babies with a little bit of bathwater. And, I think to society's detriment as a whole.
Right, right. I completely agree. And, we could probably do a sideline on drug wars and all kinds of stuff like that, but we'll save that for the controversial truth. My somewhat in hibernation political podcast, but maybe that raises a little bit of a question. I noticed reading through your blog that you would address some of the, ethical concerns around people using cognitive enhancing agents and whatnot. I'm pretty free market libertarian in that regard, and I can't think of something that could be more easily democratized than if we had agents that were safe and health promoting, say like GHB or like L-theanine or aniracetam or something like that. Like they're comparatively inexpensive, safe, maybe have some anti-aging effects to them. We can't yet alter our genetics. CRISPR isn't at a level where we can get in and tweak our genetics so that we get some sort of Superman profile in that regard. But it seems like regardless of what you're born with, if there are substances that are inexpensive and comparatively safe that could enhance what you've got, that seems like a win. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm certainly with you on that. I think that there's there definitely is a weird feeling that somehow taking something to make yourself, I'm using the term smarter in air quotes because, even defining what smarter means can be a kettle of fish.
Right.
But, that's cheating somehow. They're like, oh, well, if a student, took some compound and was able to do better on their test, that, that's unfair to the other students. To which, I kind of think, well, if the student's going to be using that same compound when he enters the workplace, then it's representative of the work that he's doing and yada, yada, yada. There are so many technologies that basically every technology that's ever been available to people that's, had some sort of beneficial effect, people have made use of, ethics be damned, as soon as it was readily available. I mean, I think about something like eyeglasses. We've had, spectacles or monocles or whatever for, 400 years now, ever since they were able to kind of, make glass with any degree of accuracy to make it, work for people that have slightly malformed eyes. And I could easily see the same arguments as are now sometimes used against cognitive enhancer drugs being used by somebody in the 1600s saying, well, it's unfair. God intended your eyes to be blurry. And
right.
why should you be able to read books clearly when God and the angels said otherwise? And I don't think those... These sound silly to us as arguments now because we've all grown up thinking, well, glasses have been around forever, right? Well, no, they haven't been around forever. At one point they were new. At one point they were very likely controversial. And I think that there's always just sort of growing pains as new things are introduced to society.
And there's kind of that curve of adoption, the early adopters, the early majority, and so on and so forth. And then eventually the people like my mom who waited until the late 1990s to buy the first microwave.
Nice. Well, she was smart in that by then it was like it was probably cheaper to buy the microwave than the food that was going in the first meal. So
right.
Yeah. So where are you at with circling back to kind of nutrition since we started off there? Where are you on the kind of cognitive performance enhancing opportunities that just basic nutrition holds? Like a lot of people find that they do well with a ketogenic diet. I would definitely stick myself in that camp. If I don't suffer blood sugar swings, my cognition is great. I don't get the hangry peaks and troughs in energy. I don't know if...
That's a great word, hangry. I hadn't heard that before. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, but I hadn't heard it.
I invented it. I don't know if somebody did.
Patent that word if it's available.
Right. Where are your thoughts on that? And how have you plugged that in also? I guess maybe one thing is, what are the different reasonable cognitive enhancing approaches? And then where might, let's say that there are some people that do just legitimately do better on a moderate to higher carb intake. Are there supplements or pharmaceuticals that are going to help that? And then on the lower carb side of things, I guess kind of the same question.
Yeah. So let's see. I guess first and foremost, even though like my show has, drug in the title, and we're talking a lot about some of these, newfangled things that have been synthesized in labs, I always try to hammer the point that, the foundational pieces of cognition are the things that people could have done forever. The, exercise, proper sleep, and, good nutrition. And even figuring out how to do those three things is still a subject of great debate. I mean, the question of what is proper human nutrition, here we are in 2016, and it still hasn't been adequately answered yet. You get, 10 nutritionists in a room and ask them, hey, what should I eat? And I mean, you can get a bar brawl out of that.
Right.
But, there are huge benefits. I think most people, let's put it this way, your average American, your average person eating a Western diet is operating below their cognitive baseline of where they should be to a very significant degree. And the amount of benefits that they're going to get from fixing up their diet and their general sort of physiological lifestyle choices is probably going to exceed anything that they could get by taking the new super capsule that's been invented in a Chinese lab in the last 10 years. That being said, the new super capsule that's been invented in a Chinese lab in the last 10 years might be a really good sort of accelerator for some type of consciousness or sort of icing on the cognitive cake. But the most important parts are obviously the things that we could have been doing forever, the diet, lifestyle, exercise choices. I succeeded. I was in ketosis for probably about 3 or 4 months about a year ago to kind of see how that went. I did like the sort of smoothness of my cognition, of not really feeling like I was, any less able to focus late in the day than I had been when I first woke up. There was just a very a nice cognitive consistency that came with that. I didn't like what I was eating as much. I mean, I really missed fruit. As somebody who, as I mentioned earlier, I was a raw vegan for a full year. And when you're a raw vegan, you're basically a fruitarian because you got to eat fruit in order to get enough calories to, survive and do any sort of exercise. It's like you're not getting those calories from eating lettuce. So, I've always been a big fan of fruit. And I really missed it, popping out of ketosis so easily, even just having, like a couple extra blueberries or whatever when I was doing the ketogenic diet. But I felt like I kind of had to give it a day at court because, here I am doing all this research into cognition, and that seemed to be something that people were talking about and a lot of people getting significant benefits from. I'm thinking that going forward, I may try to drop into a ketogenic diet for a few months out of the year, like probably during the winter months. Mm-hmm. But then as sort of things come back seasonally, like, be eating my local fruits and vegetables and all that. Dietarily for cognition, again, just, leaving all the supplements out of it, I find that probably my single biggest win is to do intermittent fasting, so I don't start eating until later in the day. So like it's 1:45 right now as we're talking. I will not eat until sometime after 4 p.m. Typically, I'll start eating between 4 and 5 and have like about a 6-7 hour eating window. And I just find that I generally do, and this is whether I'm eating carbs, which I am right now, or even eating ketogenic. I just found that I do better with feel more clear-headed and more peppy, alert, motivated with no food in my belly. Why that is anyone's guess. I think as an animal, it kind of it does make a bit of sense that if you're a little bit hungry, it's important for you to find some food rather than go to sleep. And it might be as simple as that, just the sort of the epigenetic triggers of the, hey, go do something. And in my case, instead of going out and hunting a buffalo, I'm pecking at my computer.
Right. No, so I've been working on my second book, and we have two kids, and we're getting ready to do a house remodel, and I just have all, lots of different things pulling on me. So trying to be as efficient as I can. And what I've found is that if I can get out of the house as early as possible, like get to my office by 6 or 6:30 a.m. And this is after like full night's sleep. Luckily the girls go to bed really early. And so we go to bed early. I get up, do a little bit of coffee. I do my brainwave app, the binaural beats, plus a little bit of nicotine gum. And I'll work from, 6 or 6:30 until 10 or 11. And that's when I have my first meal.
Yeah.
And I am insanely productive then. Like I'll get 2,000, occasionally 2,500 words written in that period. And then I'll bring it home and Nikki, my wife, will edit it. And she's like, dude, this is actually pretty good. It's not requiring like a massive amount of intervention and polish, and the flow is good and all that type of stuff. And so I've definitely noticed that my most productive creative time is early in the day. And if I can bracket that with an intermittent fasting period and just a skosh of appropriate stimulation. This is, again, something I've had to learn, where a little bit of caffeine, and I'm talking probably like 25 to 50 milligrams, like a quarter of a cup of normal coffee, and then just a little bit of nicotine gum, and then my binaural beats thing, I'm incredibly focused. I have good, I guess, creativity. I haven't really thought about it that way, but I'm connecting the dots on a lot of disparate topics. And that works great. And then the bulk of my writing, like kind of cognitive work, is done. And then I have some food, and then I start doing more like, running the kids around, doing laundry, cleaning the house, maybe go work out. I try to do jujitsu around 1 or 2 p.m. And that's been working really well. Like I would say that little intermittent fasting piece. And if I'm really hungry, then I go ahead and eat. I don't push that stress window particularly far, but I'm usually like a 15 to 17 hour window of fasting. Yeah. We finish dinner around like 5 or 5:30, and then we go to bed pretty early. So that's been working really well for me.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a great schedule. I mean, I'm sort of doing the same thing, except I just push my window later in the day so I can still sneak in a dessert, which tends to probably be my desserts are more fruit heavy than yours are if you're keeping on the low carb end of things.
I'm probably like 150 grams of carb, between 150 on non-training days, maybe 100 on hard training days, maybe 200. So, I mean, there's a decent amount in there.
And I think the other thing that you kind of mentioned in there that's really valuable is, we are all creatures of habit. And if you're able to build a set of, mental relationships, like, for me, I've got like productivity playlists. Like, it's not even binaural beat stuff. It's just, I really like this song, and this song gets me jacked up. And like, I do something that, I deem to be productive or effective listening to that song enough times, all of a sudden it starts becoming, something that pushes me the other way. I put the song on and I'm expecting some hard work out of myself. One of my favorite metaphors, I guess, from pop culture, even though I don't think they actually play the movie Dumbo anymore, but for people that are old enough to remember, Dumbo is this elephant with giant flapping ears, and he could fly. But at first he didn't believe he could fly, and he had this little mouse friend, and the mouse gave him this feather, which was just some random feather he picked out of a crow's ass, and said, hey, this is a magic feather, and if you hold the magic feather in your trunk, you're going to be able to flap your ears and fly. Dumbo didn't have, he had self-worth issues or whatever at the beginning of the movie, and didn't think
1940s one, right?
This is the 1940s
one. My daughters love that. Love it. Yeah.
Cool. So he doesn't believe that just flapping his ears is what's doing the trick. But he thinks he has this magic feather and that makes it work for him. And eventually, like, you know, late in the movie, he realizes, oh, the feather wasn't magic after all. That was just, you know, basically placebo effect was what was allowing him to do it. But by that point, he's flying already. And, you know, I feel like any of these things that we can use to, you know, give ourselves a little bit of a, you know, feeling of extra oomph, whether it's, you know, the cup of coffee or, you know, the writer's hat that you put on before you sit down to write, or, you know, the music that you have playing, or whatever it is. It's like, you know, stack as many of those different, you know, advantages as you possibly can and start to form those habits around, you know, your productivity cycle. And it becomes a really self-perpetuating thing.
Nice. Jesse, so my work ends up being pretty, you know, reasonably cognitively demanding, particularly when I'm in a writing mode. But I have two other real passions. One of them is longbow or recurve archery. So there's no sights on it. It's completely an instinctual thing. Highly perishable skill set. You've got to put a lot of arrows downrange to keep the skill set good. And then also I muck around with old guy Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Are there any specific substances or strategies that help the acquisition of physical kind of intelligence or aptitude? We've talked a ton about, you know, just general thinking and creativity, but, you know, all the movement related mastery is also clearly a central nervous system brain related issue. Is there anything that can help us on the acquisition of movement based activities more effectively?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I don't know if there's been any studies specifically looking at that, but muscle memory, you know, quote unquote muscle memory, is of course actually the part of the brain that controls muscular movement, sort of the cortex. And So I think anything that would be a memory booster would probably be helping with those acquisition of physical skills as well. And probably also anything that's going to help with sleep, since sleep is where we consolidate long-term memory and sort of move things into, you know, from short-term storage. And so I would say generally memory promoting and or sleep promoting compounds are going to help with the that physical skill acquisition.
So I need to put together a lab here at the Lazy Lobo Ranch and start synthesizing GHB so I can get better sleep, is what you're saying. Okay, perfect.
If you do it, count me your first under the table buyer.
Oh man, the DEA is going to be out at our place here in like three days after this thing airs.
This is a prank awesome. Call, right?
Completely prank call, just purely theoretical. Funny and not funny. The GHB is up there. Like, if you get caught with that, it's cocaine, heroin type of deal. Like, you're going to the big house.
Drug scheduling is just, I mean, again, we don't need to go down this road, but it's ridiculous. It's like heroin is less highly scheduled than something like GHB or marijuana, because the opioids have, you know, legitimate medical uses for pain reduction.
Right.
But apparently sleep promotion and GHB, or the many sorts of pain reduction that we actually know, you know, the cannabinoids in marijuana can do, for whatever reason, that didn't pass the threshold that day at the DEA when they were scheduling these things.
Dude. Oh yeah. I'll have to get you on the political podcast sometime and we'll,
can I give you one more? Just
cause, yeah, please.
So I interviewed a guy in the UK. His name is Dr. David Nutt. Really, really interesting guy. And got in a lot of trouble with the UK's version of the DEA for some of the things he said. He was kind of like the UK's version of the drug czar, and then started saying some things that were rationally true, but were not politically what the powers that be wanted to hear. But anyway, he made the really interesting point that during, I think it was the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a major push in Britain against the use of MDMA, against ecstasy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were billboards on the streets and stuff like that. And you would kind of think that that would have been something that was largely funded by tax dollars, the campaign against the use of these recreational drugs. But it was actually funded in large part by the alcohol industry. The alcohol industry has, you know, in the UK, as in the US, a legal monopoly on intoxication. And they were willing to spend a lot of money to, you know, work to protect that legal monopoly on intoxication that they have. And I just think it's fascinating looking at how the money changes hands on these things and how it affects public policy.
Oh, that's fascinating. Oh, yeah, we definitely need to get you on the political podcast. Most of the folks on this one, we keep it protein, carbs, fat. There are a few people that will go down the libertarian market-based rabbit hole with me and not raise a stink, but other folks get super bent. So I try to keep the different populations separated so that
we don't cross the streams.
Yeah, don't cross the streams. It's just bad. Jesse, where can folks track you down on the interwebs to learn more about what you're doing and follow your work?
Yeah, I'm relatively findable. I've got a podcast called Smart Drug Smarts, and the website, not surprisingly, is smartdrugsmarts.com. We come out every Friday. It's generally me interviewing some sort of neuroscientist or a medical doctor, talking specifically about stuff that either helps you preserve your brain or enhance your brain. And sort of the meta theme is anything I find interesting. So we get some oddball topics in there every now and then, but it's generally brain-based.
Awesome. Awesome. Jesse, it's been a ton of fun having you on the show. Let's circle back maybe 4 to 6 months and get you back on. And maybe what we can do when we bring you back on, we can open this up to social media and ask folks if they have specific questions for you. And then we can get some of their specific, needs, wants, and desires addressed.
That sounds fantastic. I would love that.
Awesome, man. Well, have a great day and I'll talk to you soon.
Cool, man. Thank you.
Bye, Jesse. Bye-bye.